So I'm going to talk about subsidies, the U.S. subsidies, how they affect agricultural trade and how that interplays with the WTO. First, though, I'd like to dedicate my talk today to Al Krebs. He was a speaker for our Food and Ag Day 10 years ago. He died a couple years ago. He was an alumnus of Seattle U and one hell of a fighter for family farms and farm workers. Well, since 2001, the WTO has been talking through negotiations regarding the Doha round, and that was ostensibly to promote developing countries, the welfare and reduced poverty in the developing part of the world. What's at stake here are hundreds of millions of families who are deluged by agricultural products from the United States and from the European, who have huge subsidy programs, and I'm going to talk a lot about agricultural dumping, meaning the United States corporations and European Union corporations can sell their commodities below cost of production around the world, which creates havoc, to say the least, euphemistically. It cuts out developing growers' own markets locally, as well as quite easily shutting them out of international markets. Our friends at the Institute for Ag and Trade Policy have studied, did an analysis of how much of we're supporting our commodities. For wheat, they found that the average price on the world market was 28% below the cost of production. Soybeans, 10% below cost of production. Corn, 10%. Rice, 26%. And cotton, not surprisingly, 47% below the cost of production. Phil is going to talk probably a lot about the WTO cotton ruling in 2006, which is tied directly to that that figure I just gave. But where do these subsidy programs come from in the United States? It's a federal program instituted at the start of the New Deal. Some people would say it was ostensibly to support family farms. I would take a little more radical analysis of that and say that after World War I, the commodity markets crashed and you were starting to see some pretty rebellious, almost revolutionary sentiments in the countryside. And I don't think that was taken lightly. And so my analysis is that these huge programs helped capitalism survive as well as helped the capitalists survive. Farm bills get renewed about every 4 or 5 years. We had one in 96, 2002, and the last one was enacted in 2008. The 96 Farm Bill was notable for its attempt to get rid of it got rid of some supply management programs, so hence the world market got flooded with commodities. They were attempting to phase those commodity subsidies out. The markets went bust. They had to have several emergency programs that cost billions of dollars. And I think it led up to what we're seeing now of the U.S. Subsidies being challenged successfully, and who knows what's going to happen in the future as well. The Farm Bill is huge. It's roughly $309 billion over 5 years. A large piece of that is in Title I. There are 15 titles. It covers research, conservation, et cetera. But Title I covers the commodity subsidy programs. And the projection is that those commodity subsidy programs will cost $72 to $74 billion, with a B, dollars, over the next 5 years. We have three types of subsidies in the Farm Bill, in general categories. The direct payments to growers, in WTO lingo, it's decoupled from market prices and current production, direct payments going to growers based on calculations called base acreage and calculations on average yield. The WTO places those kind of subsidies gives them a green light, so to speak, and puts them in the green box. You're going to hear me talk about green box, blue box, amber box. Those are WTO classifications for support programs for farmers. The other type of subsidy, you've got direct payments, then you've got counter-cyclical payments, meaning that growers are paid to limit their production. And the WTO has this, these programs were taken out in 96, reinstituted in 2002. The U.S. was hoping that these programs would be placed in what's called the blue box, because that's largely an exempt category. But the cotton ruling, which again Phil's going to talk about, placed some of the, at least those cotton counter cyclical payments in the amber box, which we would call it the yellow light. It's on the traffic light spectrum, as in amber would mean slow down, prepare to stop, lower your subsidies. The other kind of subsidy in the farm bill that the U.S. Gives its growers are marketing loans and loan deficiency payments. One basic mechanism is growers are given financing at the beginning of the crop year, which actually is quite needed and quite necessary, and then they're given a target price. So if at the end of the crop year, if the market price is below the target price, they can forfeit. They don't have to repay the loan, and they'll forfeit their commodities they've grown, give that to the government. But if things go well, the market price is high, they can pay off the loan and keep the profit above that. The Environmental Working Group has done quite a bit of analysis on who gets subsidies. There's some contention of what they include or don't include in those measures. They don't accurately capture who's actively farming necessarily. Including quite a bit of, quote, hobby farmers or landlords in their analysis. But nonetheless, it's quite well known that most of the subsidies go to large-scale growers, and it's a bias towards large operations. The Farm Bill in 08 put limits on payments, but again, our friends at the Center for Rural Affairs in Nebraska and many others have shown that it's quite, if you have an accountant and you can do a little bit of studying and split your property among family, you can get around those payment limitations quite easily. So overall, even though we had the cotton ruling in 06, Congress came along and passed the Farm Bill in 08 and didn't really change the structure of the commodity subsidy programs, even though there have been challenges to the quantity and agricultural dumping, as well as, I'll just leave it at that. So there are some good, really good things in the Farm Bill of 08, but the basic structure, unfortunately, didn't change. So we go to the WTO framework. How does the WTO classify these support programs? I was talking about the green box. It's pretty much direct payments to farmers that's not linked to production and prices. It might be for environmental practices, funding of research and extension, agricultural infrastructure. That's all in the green box. It's not deemed trade distorting. Then you get the blue box, where things start to get a lot more contentious. And the U.S. has been hoping and pushing to get their counter-cyclical payments into that blue box, because in many ways it's exempt from a complicated measure called the aggregate measure of support. But the G20, a group of developing countries, as well as other associations of developing countries, are fighting this, and because it would be largely a way for the U.S. and probably the European Union as well to not reform their subsidy programs and get it exempt. I've mentioned the amber box. That is basically the U.S. is given $19 billion annually to put into their support programs into this category. And if their counter-cyclical payments go blue box, then there's going to be quite a change on the horizon. Or, although I can be a cynical, and if voting made a difference, so the saying goes, it would be outlawed. And I would contend that if some of these rules made a difference, it would be outlawed, meaning that if the Amber Box came into affected dramatically the subsidies, I think you'll see quite a bit of action on that front. So the WTO talks about domestic programs, export subsidies, and Mark mentioned tariffs under market access. One thing that's come into play is called the expiration of the peace clause. Under the WTO's agreement on agriculture, disputes used to be governed by the peace clause. That expired at the end of 2003. So since 2004, it's been easier for developing countries to challenge developed country subsidy programs. And I think that sets the stage for some of these things, these challenges we're hearing about. Cotton has been challenged. Canada is developing a challenge to the U.S. corn subsidy programs. So who wins and who loses in this kind of arrangement? Who wins with subsidies? It creates commodities that are extremely cheap. So buyers of commodities, factory farms, Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, those are the winners. I'm not saying we should toss out subsidies. I'm saying we should target them to the values that we hold of family farms, farmers that are doing farming sustainably, farmers that support local communities. And I think we should go beyond those kind of reform measures and talk about subsidizing or supporting farm workers, not necessarily owners of the land. I think that, and God forbid we should have land reform in our own country and enforce some of our antitrust legislation so we don't get millions of farmers pit up against a handful of processors or buyers for their products. And I'll wrap this up. On the WTO side of things, more trade liberalization, and I'm borrowing this quote from Darrell Ray, isn't the answer, at least in my opinion. At a minimum, we need to outlaw export dumping, make it easier or enforce prompt and stringent notification of their subsidy programs by the developed countries, make it easier for poor countries to challenge those programs. And I'll leave it at that. There are some interesting things happening, and for once in for quite a while, developing countries have been able to challenge some of these huge subsidy programs.
Well, I'll talk a little bit more about the WTO in general and then talk about a specific dispute. Now, the theory behind the WTO is that each country, which is sovereign and controls its borders, gives up some of that sovereignty at the border as to what can come in, and that as a result of that, all of the countries will prosper because of trade. So you have to remember that the basic idea is that every country, you know, can control its borders and so forth. But people, countries, when they adhere to the WTO, give up part of that. The New York Times, in an editorial, May 15th, 2006, said, quote, "Back in 1947, when 23 nations agreed to start an international organization to promote trade and arbitrate disputes, the needs of poor countries mattered little." I'm not saying this, but the New York Times is saying this. "Industrialized nations were rebuilding after World War II, and they remained the economic masters of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Over the next 50 years, that club, now known as the World Trade Organization, aggressively dismantled barriers against trade in industrial goods and services, the areas in which its members had a comparative advantage." So according to the New York Times, what might have started as a relatively neutral kind of thing, let's increase the general prosperity by reducing this control at our borders, became very soon into a rich countries club against the poorer countries. Okay. Now, why do poor countries join the WTO? Which they do. Less developed countries have been eager to join, and this goes to studies that I'm sure many of you are familiar with about elites within developing countries who, of course, are trained in the U.S. or Western Europe and absorb those ideas, or they might just be naivete. They might believe the rhetoric that's fostered on them. Okay, so as a result, we've had an increasing number of countries joining the WTO. Now, after Seattle, first of all, the WTO has two major functions. One is like a legislative function, which was what John was talking about, the boxes and what's allowed and what's not allowed. And then a kind of quasi-judicial function, which is that members can bring disputes against other members if they feel. It's like filing a case, going down to the courthouse and filing the case. Now, Seattle did a couple of things, and by the way, I should say the Seattle Times is going to have lots of articles tomorrow, including stuff online, and I have a piece that's going to be online that's going to touch on what I'm going to say right now. One of the things that Seattle, by the time of the Seattle round and why Seattle collapsed, was not only the people outside on the street, but what was going on inside. Many of the third world countries, particularly the Africans, by this stage of the game, by 1999, knew that they had to hang together or each would hang separately. And they had put up a united front in a number of areas that were in issue at the ministerial. So you should keep that in mind, that the WTO itself has its own internal dynamic, which is dysfunctional. Okay? Now you get the trade ministers of these third world countries going along with it, and you have the ag minister, the environmental ministers, or the health ministers, or whatever, of those same countries realizing that their people and their interests that they're trying to promote are getting screwed over, right? The lack of access to AIDS drugs, for example, because they were patented. So people should understand that within the WTO, and it depends upon which ministries are doing what. The trade ministries are all people who've gone to business schools in the north and so forth, and they all think a certain way. So even if the health minister of one of these countries wants to import an AIDS drug, the TRIPS agreement, the trade-related industrial property agreement, may restrict that because the drug might be patented. Okay, so in addition to these kind of supports, the intellectual property protections are very, very powerful in terms of some of the issues that we're all concerned about. And as Mark and John have both said, the results of all of this is that U.S. corn is cheaper in Mexico than Mexican corn, U.S. rice is cheaper in Thailand than Thai rice, et cetera, et cetera. Now, so after Seattle, what happened was they got together again for a ministerial, and they intentionally put it in Doha, where it was no protests are allowed in Doha, and most of us did not go. The number of NGOs who went and had been going to the WTO dropped drastically. And what they came up with, because of the insistence of third world countries, is called a development round. And if you go into the details of it, the Doha Agreement says that the WTO rules should be to foster development in the third world countries, which, of course, is totally the opposite of what the New York Times editorial said the purpose of the WTO really was, isn't it? So this is another kind of internal contradiction within the WTO, which we're seeing being played out now, okay? So the following WTO meeting was in Cancun, and that's the one that the reference was made this morning where the Korean farmer killed himself as part of the protests against what was going on, because there was tremendous unity, again, among inside-outside, delegations on the inside, from third world countries, particularly the more progressive ones and the ones that aren't completely in the pocket of the U.S. or France or Britain or whatever, and what was going outside, an enormous contingent of agricultural workers from different countries. And there were posters up all around, you know, in Cancun, something to the effect of, in the United States, the average cow receives a subsidy of $2,500 a year, while the average person in Africa earns closer to 1/20th of that. I'm going to give you an example of cotton, because at Cancun, cotton was on the agenda. We're talking legislatively now. In the ministerial agenda, the only very, very specific, if you look, go back and look at, which you can find on the website, that agenda is the issue of cotton raised by Burkina Faso, Mali, Benin, and Chad. One of the four of the poorest, most destitute countries in the world. And their only crop is cotton. And guess what? U.S. cotton is selling cheaper in Burkina Faso than Burkina Fasoine cotton is being sold. Okay? It used to be called Upper Volta. Some of you may remember that name. Burkina Faso has a GDP of $15.4 billion a year, putting it 116th in the world. Its per capita GDP is about $300, or roughly a dollar a day. But in terms of local purchasing power, maybe it's equivalent to $3 a day, okay? The vast majority of its population is farmers and herders. The U.S. population contains about 3 million farmers, only 1% of our total. Farm subsidies are currently running at $23 billion a year. These figures are from about 2 or 3 years ago when I first wrote up some of this. An average of $8,000 per year from the government, a government grant to each farm resident in the U.S. Thus, the subsidies that a U.S. farmer gets are 27 times what a person in Burkina Faso earns. Okay? Burkina Faso, Mali, Benin, and Chad are a roll call of wretchedness. In Benin, 62% of the people live in houses with dirt floors. So at the Cancun ministerial, they attempted to get a ruling that would terminate U.S. cotton subsidies so the Africans could sell their cotton, at decent prices, which is their only resource. That meeting also collapsed. You're not maybe as aware of that, but that meeting went home without doing anything. It didn't collapse in exactly that. They were able to meet, unlike Seattle, but they were not able to do anything because the third world countries were maintaining a unified front. What happened subsequently was that none of these four countries is wealthy enough to take a challenge against the United States at the WTO. Okay? Most of these countries can't even maintain an ambassador in Geneva, where the WTO has its headquarters. So these countries are not represented when the WTO has its regular meetings, you know, in Geneva, week after week after week. None of these countries are even there because they can't afford to have anyone there. Okay? Brazil on its own, it's a major cotton producer, and in a very gallant kind of way, as champion of these four countries, brought a dispute against the U.S. Two of the countries of the four came in as third parties. There is a way to intervene, which basically means you're an interested bystander. You don't control it at all. The dispute was filed in 2002. And in 2004, the U.S. Lost in the first ruling. The ruling of the dispute panel was that these subsidies are illegal. Okay? And that they should be terminated at the end of 2005, and that the U.S. should pay damages estimated at $4 billion. Now, when a country loses at the WTO, it has a couple of options as to what it can do. It can, in fact, change the rule that the WTO says a violation, okay? It can instead pay damages. Or it can instead have its exports tariffs. The winner can levy tariffs against its exports, okay? So all of those are three options and so forth. And, of course, the U.S. has not, Burkina Faso is not about Brazil might level some tariffs on U.S. goods, but you can't imagine Burkina Faso, right, leveling tariffs on U.S. goods, and, I mean, it's just not a reality. Anyway, the U.S. hasn't done anything, and as John pointed out, subsequent to that, the U.S. Farm Bill passed, and it had the same subsidies that the WTO had ruled illegal. Okay? So we have to understand that among all the other things about it, about that the U.S. is branded a violator of the WTO at the same time that it promotes the WTO and pushes it on other countries. Okay, that's part of the reality. Now, when you get to these negotiations, the U.S. trade rep is there and having all these discussions with the Brazilians and the Indians have become major players at the WTO because of these dynamic that Seattle embodied, the collapse. When I say that the third world was getting its together, which I didn't say, but I will put it that way. Obviously, you know enough to know that Brazil and India are emerging enormous powers, and of course China too. But China always was a case of its own, what we lawyers call sui generis. It's always a unique case. So the U.S. trade rep can sit in a room and resist and resist and resist and finally give in, and they can all think they have an agreement legislatively, but the fact of the matter is that farming interests, and this is in response to the guy sitting on the floor there, the farm interests are too large. Every state has two senators. okay? And the states that get farm subsidies comprise the whole Midwest. And you are not getting a farm bill through that doesn't have lots of goodies for their constituents, okay? And it doesn't matter. They don't give a shit what the U.S. trade rep said in Cancun or said in Doha or said in Hong Kong, which was the subsequent one, all right? So you have this another disconnect between the political realities domestically here and what the U.S. says when it's negotiating with these other countries. And eventually, if not already, the other countries are going to get wise to the fact that the U.S. system is such that the trade rep can't deliver what the trade rep promises. Okay? So let me just tell you the follow-up in 2 seconds. You don't need to give me that. I'm winding up. The follow-up was, so what happens when there's an appeal process? So, of course, the U.S. took an appeal. Oh, we're innocent. We haven't done anything. Don't attack us and so forth. And then if you lose the appeal, which the U.S. did, you can go to arbitration, okay, which they did. At any rate, September 1st, 2009, in other words, just a few weeks ago, the preceding couple of days, the end of August, the arbitrator made the ruling and, I'll read you one or two selections from the New York Times and from the Financial Times. The WTO approves $295 million in sanctions against the U.S. American goods will face about $295 million in annual sanctions as a result of the United States' failure to eliminate illegal subsidies to domestic cotton growers, the World Trade Organization ruled on Monday. The size of the penalty was disappointing from Brazil. Brazil asked for something like $4 billion a year in the sanctions. Washington had argued that the award should not exceed $30 million. This is the fifth major decision in this case since the Brazilian government brought the case in 2002. Okay? The trade group's condemnation of the United States in September 2004, that's the earlier one, was seen as a victory for Brazil and for West African countries that claimed to have been harmed by the subsidies. Three decisions since have confirmed that. So you have a situation, one quote from the Financial Times on the same story. Carol Guthrie, spokeswoman for the U.S. Trade Rep's office, said, "While we remain disappointed with the outcome of this dispute, we are pleased that the arbitrators awarded Brazil far below the amount of countermeasures it asked for." Yeah, we're pleased. We're only paying $300 million instead of $4 billion a year. I'd be pleased, wouldn't you? As the Financial Times mentions, but not the New York Times, and this is John's point, that U.S. publications don't carry these things. The Financial Times, published in London, mentions last year's farm bill entrenches other programs, including marketing loan payments, countercyclical payments, and export credit guarantees, which have been held to breach WTO rules. All right? So that contradiction is noted in the Financial Times of Britain, but not in the New York Times from New York. The Obama administration has followed its predecessor in arguing significant cuts in U.S. cotton subsidies must be condemned. By the way, George Bush did argue in the Farm Bill discussions for cuts in subsidies. I will give him that. I don't give him very much about anything, but I will give him that. And Obama's doing the same, but the reality is that they're not going to be cut. What does this mean? I don't know. Stay tuned, folks. The last chapter has not yet been written.
Rather than talk about the WTO, I'm going to be talking about one of the specific trade agreements that the WTO is set up to regulate. So I'm going to be talking about the North American Free Trade Agreement and its impacts on corn farmers in Mexico. And one of the things I want to talk about is not only how the North American Free Trade Agreement has hurt corn farmers in Mexico, but some of the ways that farmers have defied the assumptions behind free trade and behind NAFTA. So NAFTA, like all free trade agreements, is based on the assumption that we're all economically rational. So that means we're going to do whatever we can to make the most money that we can. And if something that we're doing isn't going to make us money, we're going to switch and do something else. It also assumes that any given country that can do something most efficiently or cheaply is the country that ought to be doing it, and other countries should find something that they can do efficiently. So that's the idea of comparative advantage. So in the case of Mexico and corn farmers, the architects of NAFTA said that corn farmers in the U.S. grow corn most efficiently, far more efficiently than corn farmers in Mexico. And as we already heard from John, this is just from the beginning a completely unfair setup because corn farmers in the U.S. are incredibly heavily subsidized. So our corn products in the U.S. are extremely cheap. Nonetheless, in spite of the fact that Mexicans don't have this, don't have this kind of advantage, the idea was that we're going to start exporting huge amounts of corn into Mexico, and Mexican corn producers are going to find something else to do. So for big corn producers in Mexico, the idea was, okay, people can grow fruit instead and export it to the U.S. For small farmers, for people who maybe worked as wage laborers in cornfields, they would find a different comparative advantage, probably just being cheap labor. So people should stop growing corn and go to work in factories or immigrate to the U.S. For service jobs. And this was really basically the ideology behind NAFTA and its assumptions. NAFTA completely ignored a whole host of factors about Mexico. So it ignored the fact that Mexico is where corn was domesticated over 5,000 years ago. NAFTA ignored the fact that Mexico is the center of genetic biodiversity for corn. Mexican corn farmers grow thousands and thousands of varieties of corn and maintain those varieties, which is extremely important. They also ignored the fact that at the time that NAFTA was signed, 60% of Mexico's cultivated land was devoted to growing corn. So this is just a massively important product. Additionally, at the time of signing, 8% of Mexico's population, the entire population, 8%, was deriving their main source of income from growing corn. And 40% of the people working in agriculture in Mexico were working growing corn. But NAFTA passed. The idea was we're gonna stop growing corn. Mexico's going to stop growing corn. We're going to get cheap corn from the U.S., and that'll be that. But a surprising thing happened, which was that after NAFTA, actually the land devoted to growing corn actually increased. Researchers in Mexico were running around scrambling to document the decline in corn production. And instead what they found was that people were going to great lengths and really creative lengths to stay on the land. So when young folks in the family were going to work in factories or migrating to the U.S., the family was using those remittances in many cases to purchase the inputs to continue growing corn. So this really defied completely the logic of what everyone thought was going to happen. And this isn't, and the prices of corn did drop drastically. So in the years following NAFTA, the price of corn in Mexico dropped by about 45%. So this was a massive, massive decrease, right? And the pressures on farmers were huge. But people decided to continue to grow corn and actually increase the production of corn. So there are specific examples of this from all over Mexico in addition to just the statistics showing that corn production increased. So Puebla, Guanajuato, Oaxaca, Yucatan, very diverse parts of Mexico. People found the same thing, that corn farmers have continued to grow corn. So just in thinking about some of the reasons why, I think there are a whole host of reasons and that there hasn't been a huge amount of work done on this, so there's a lot of work to be done in figuring out, you know, why does this matter so much that people are going to these lengths. But I think some of the reasons are social. Corn is a huge part of Mexican national identity and has been for hundreds of years, but especially since the Revolution of Mexico in 1910. There's a group that protests NAFTA called Sin Maíz No Hay País. Without corn, there is no country. So it's a very visceral kind of piece of national identity. For many indigenous folks in Mexico, corn is just completely wrapped up in identity, community, ritual, sort of the stages of life, reciprocity, and so you can't sort of be who you are without corn. So the idea that you would just stop growing corn because you can't make money doing it just doesn't make any sense. It also plays a role for subsistence farmers in security. This is not the first time in Mexico that the price of corn has been cheaper than the cost of production. Mexican farmers, including subsistence farmers, have been part of a global marketplace for a long, long time now. And so there's actually been many examples over the past few hundred years of people deciding to continue to grow corn, even when they couldn't make any money growing corn on the market. And so it acts as a kind of, you know, when you're in this kind of boom and bust economy, global marketplace, growing your own corn and having corn to feed your family is a way to stay secure. Finally, the U.S. corn that is being exported to Mexico is a hybrid yellow corn called yellow corn number 2, which is viewed in Mexico as animal food. So most of the corn consumed in Mexico is a criollo corn called just a white corn. And there's a lot of disgust at the idea of eating this hybrid U.S. corn. So there are, for people who can afford it, there are kind of niche markets where people will buy criollo corn, which is indigenous corn, from corn farmers, small farmers, and are happy to pay more money, just like many of us will go to a farmer's market before we're going to buy the crop they sell at a regular supermarket. And for many small farmers, even who have very, very little money, the idea of eating this kind of outside trash food just doesn't cut it, right? People want to eat human food, not animal food. And this has been the source of protests as well, protesting the importation of animal food. So these are kind of, I think, a good aspect, right? We've seen people just defying the assumptions of NAFTA. So I wish that that was the whole story, but I think that NAFTA has very much distorted corn production in Mexico in a lot of ways. So I already mentioned how much the price of corn went down, and that's had huge impacts on people's capacity to make a living. For the environment, I mentioned that the acreage of corn in Mexico devoted to corn production has increased. And part of that is that there aren't as many people working in corn production. So farmers are going into more and more marginal land and letting go of practices that help preserve the land and stop soil erosion, things like that. So it's actually had a very detrimental impact environmentally for Mexico. There's sort of no clear future for corn production. Most of the young people are working in the United States. There are whole, you can go to Mexico and find that the entire town you're visiting, all the young people are in the U.S. working. So will those young kids come back and decide to be corn farmers in the next 20 years or so? Who knows? So that's a huge question. The price of tortillas. So most, you know, Mexicans eat tortillas as the main staple food. Many people have argued that, okay, NAFTA did all these horrible things to corn farmers, but you're going to have cheap corn tortillas for the urban poor to eat because you can use this hybrid U.S. corn and sell it cheap. But actually, since NAFTA, tortilla prices have steadily increased. There's kind of one monopoly tortilla seller in Mexico, Maseca. That's actually a multinational company. You can see their products here as well. And they have continued getting subsidies from the Mexican government after corn farmers stopped getting subsidies. And they kind of fixed their prices, lowered their prices, and used all the extra money they got to continue their expansion multinationally. And then you probably all have read about the huge price increases worldwide in food. Those price increases really impacted Mexico. Tortilla prices went up astronomically, and there were huge protests in the streets of Mexico City. So, finally, GMOs. NAFTA originally said that there wouldn't be any GMO corn crops grown in Mexico, but there's been from the beginning a lot of concern about GMO products from the U.S. contaminating Mexican corn. So, in 1991, two researchers published an article in the journal Nature, and they published that they had found that indigenous corn varieties in Oaxaca had been contaminated with Roundup Ready and BT corn. And these are Berkeley scientists, and they had did all their controls and their lab tests. But the next month, Nature published a disclaimer saying that they didn't think this was accurate science, and they had never done that before. And this was after a campaign by Monsanto to discredit them. So, meanwhile, just last month, Mexico started laboratory sort of test plots of GMO corn, and we'll be allowing more and more GMO corn to be produced in Mexico. 2,000 scientists just signed a petition saying that there are absolutely not systems in place to keep indigenous Mexican corn varieties from being contaminated. So just wrapping up, I'd just say that the, you know, the assumptions of free trade, just in and of themselves, they just don't apply to how people make decisions and what really happens on the ground. And, you know, I'm happy, very happy to see that corn production has continued in Mexico, but there are some incredibly frightening trends that have come into play thanks to NAFTA. So, thanks.
Claire, I just wanted to, I think you misstated something. It was Mexican law that forbid the planting of GMOs. I think you said NAFTA.
You
probably just slid over it. And so the key thing is that then there was this contamination, which, by the way, the Mexican government verified. And now they've completely 180 degrees changed their position and said that GMO corn can be these experimental plots. Yeah.
It's beyond experimental plots. Monsanto just got permission from the government to pay farmers 800 pesos a hectare to plant GMO corn.
Okay, so I hope there won't be need for many, many clarification questions after I'm done. I'm going to try to bring this more to home. We've been talking about impacts in developing countries. I like to look upon our country as a redeveloping country. We have been, as Wendell Berry says, colonizing our own economy. And so where I'm going to try to bring sort of conceptual ideas of what the farm can bring to the world. And I think Dina will speak more of what the world, all these policies and subsidies are bringing impact on American farms. This farm I'm talking about is a particular picture of a farm. It's a very low input farm, more like what we call the family farm, a mixed farm. And I'm going to try in this context to ask two questions. What sort of trading do we need? And the next question will be, can the world be fed without trade? So, because that's often a context of why we need this kind of trading, this free trading. So I'm going to take an urban homesteader's perspective, and you can find this all the way back to 1920 in the person who coined the phrase organic agriculture. And that was first used in a book by Lord Northbourne in England in 1940 called Look to the Land. You can still find copies on the thanks to the internet and use book searches. Look to the Land. And the key concept in here is also a key concept for what is called biodynamic agriculture. That's sort of my field of expertise or study. And this is the idea of the farm individuality, that a farm provides for its own inputs, for its own capitalization, we might say, for its own security. This is an ideal to work toward. It's not a constriction and something that you absolutely must do, but an ideal to work toward. Now, I say an urban homesteader's perspective. I live in Seattle. I have my chickens, my gardens, looking to get my goats. You know, but it's more than just doing that. It's a perspective that you take, a perspective that we are all producers, first of all. So all economy begins from agriculture, forestry, and mining. You know, we would be doing that were we not getting wage jobs and the other things that we do. I have a farmer friend out in Jubilee Farm out in Carnation said, we wouldn't trade this for anything, working on the farm. And it occurred to me, we've all traded it for something else, including myself living in town. Now, this notion of the farm individuality then means that even as a homestead, I try to look at what I bring in home as a substitute for what I would do otherwise. And Wendell Berry speaks of this as proxy. We give proxy to others in the world, to these trade organizations, to subsidy programs, to local farmers. We make choices. And these are important. And the perspective we have in those choices is important. In his essay, Distrust of Movements, the second condition that Wendell Berry gives for participating in a movement on telling people what the economy is that people in this movement should take full responsibility for themselves as members of the economy. Now, I said I'm a small-time educator, so I have to write something on the board. Of course, I have to give you some words that you might not know. And these come from Aristotle. Economia and crematistics. Now, I'll just... These are foreign words. The word economia is the root, of course, for economics, the word we use today for economics. It's also the root word for ecology. The oikos is the home. Oikonomia is the management of the home, or the management of the homestead. And I'll read here from Herman Daly and John Cobb Jr. from their book For the Common Good, chapter 7, From Crematistics to Economia. Aristotle made a very important distinction between economia and crematistics. The former, of course, is the root from which our word economics derives. Crematistics is a word that these days is found mainly in unabridged dictionaries. It can be defined as the branch of political economy relating to the manipulation of property and wealth so as to maximize short-term monetary exchange value to the owner. The purpose of the WTO. Economia, by contrast, is the management of the household so as to increase its use value to all members of the household over the long run. If we expand the concept of household to include the larger community of the land, of shared values, resources, biomes, institutions, language, and history, then we have a good definition of economics for community. Now, crematistics then was a trading in coin, pure financial bubbles like we have today. So crematistics is largely what we have for economy, trying to push us towards something that's more like an economia, which would be local living economies, which would be natural relations among people. For Aristotle, crematistics was unnatural, like incest. So this parallels other polarities. Wendell Berry speaks of agrarian interests or values versus industrial urban values. Or we might say being customers rather than consumers. Customers who know the relations that we have in our economic work. So what sort of trading do we need? We would want trading that's more on the notion, you know, it's not anti-globalization. We can't grow bananas here. You know, we need to trade for certain things. There will be advantages in certain areas. But we have to have something that gives us a relation to where we're trading. We're getting a coffee where we actually know something about the coffee growers, etc. And then can the world be fed without the kind of export free market trading that is brought up? There's a wonderful article by Fred Kirschenmann, who is emeritus person at the Leopold Institute for Sustainable Agriculture. In 1999, this book, For All Generations, came out. Right after the article, Can an Organic Twinkie Be Certified? Fred Kirschenmann wrote, Can Organic Agriculture Feed the World? And then dot, 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 and is that the right question? These sorts of subsidies and actions interfere with the world being able to feed itself. It's a matter of power relations, Fred said, and farmer and community-driven food security and economic relation rather than market-driven, crematistic food security. The kind of food security that you hear in the news through the WTO, et cetera, through genetic and engineering and all these things, that kind of food security is a dependence for other countries and our own country being put dependent on these sorts of technologies. A third thing, there's often thought, it's said that we need to have this intensive agriculture to produce enough to feed the world. You know, there's more produced than the world eats. And there's a book back in 1965, The Conditions of Agricultural Growth, which works ass backwards to Malthus and his thesis that, you know, we're limited by agricultural production. She pointed out in case conditions around the developing world that as things get better and the population gets increased, agriculture intensifies. And it intensifies on this small-scale, low-input way. And it's adequate. That's what I would trust. We don't know for sure, but that's the road I would take.
There are lots of reasons why agriculture shouldn't be in the WTO. One of them is that food is not like any other commodity. There isn't price responsiveness on either the demand or the supply end. On the supply end, you never know when you plant a crop if you're going to get half a crop or no crop at all, because you can't control all the variables like drought or hail or rain or insects or disease. On the demand end, you don't know when some other country is going to have a huge bumper crop and nobody's going to need what you produce. So it can't be regulated in the same way that the manufacturer of can openers could. If there's a lot of can openers and nobody's buying them, he just quits manufacturing them. You can't just stop growing if you're a farmer. So we have had farm policy that helps the myth of the cheap food, and legislators will tell you, well, we have a cheap food policy in this country, and that is why we can't have farm policy that actually supports family agriculture. For one thing, as Phil said, that the U.S. doesn't respond to WTO rulings against it. At the same time, they will use the WTO as an excuse not to institute decent farm policy, saying, well, we don't think that is compliant. The National Family Farm Coalition had Food from Family Farms Act that was covered all the bases of farmer-owned reserves, so we wouldn't have $2 wheat or $20 wheat. It had protections for the environment, for farm workers, for food workers all the way through the food chain, and we heard it's not WTO compliant. Well, who made the damn rules? And who approved the rules? We didn't, but we're living under them. So consequently, farmers get subsidies because they can't make money in the marketplace. It's totally manipulated so that big corporations can buy whatever we produce for cheaper than it costs us to produce it, so they can export it and make money. So as long as farmers aren't making money, rural communities are not going to be successful, and we're always told farming is not a way of life, farming is a business. Well, who in the hell would stay in a business that lost money every year? We've been on the farm we're on now for 30 years. We have never made money. But we eat well, and our neighbors eat well, and our friends eat well, and our extended family eats well, and we have managed to subsidize ourselves by my husband working off the farm for 32 years, and now his pension is subsidizing our farm. But we're not going away. A lot of people who didn't work off the farm and have that pension are in the spot where they live off their equity, they borrow more and more money against the value of their farm, and farms and ranches are going up because of their value to people who are speculating in land. They have no intention of farming or using it for agriculture purposes, but they want the land for hunting or fishing or a little retreat or just to speculate on the value going up. So when they're done borrowing on their equity and they go to the bank and the bank says, sorry, we're not giving you any more money, then there's a farm sale and they're gone. So their children can never come there. So people who want to farm can never come there because it goes to a non-agricultural purpose. So what are we going to do about it? Well, lots is going on. There are a lot of things that are happening all over the world to keep people on the farm. And the National Family Farm Coalition has a group called Farm Not Arms, and they work with veterans to team them up with an older farmer who might be going out of the farm, and it's kind of rehab for them too. They work on the farm, they learn how to farm, and they're trying to make them be able to be farm owners. I like the idea of farm workers and migrants being able to come in and take over farms. We need more people on the farms, and a good thing is that as of the 2007 census, there were 130,000 more farms in this country, many of them run by women and younger people, all of them smaller, diversified, and most of them are organic. So that's good news, and we need more of that to happen, lots more of that to happen. But until we break the stranglehold of corporations and TNCs on the whole political process, we're going to just be pawns in a game of of international capital in our only role as people is going to be to keep consuming as much as we can afford and to keep consuming what we can't afford on credit, to work as cheaply as possible. And one of my cousin's fathers has this great quotation. He always says, yep, we're just being taught to buy things we don't need to impress people who don't give a shit. We're also needed to fight in wars that fill corporate pockets, and when we aren't of any use, we can just die, because, of course, we can't afford to have health care for everybody, so when you're of no more use, you should just go away. So, when money talks, morals walk, and so do ethics. So, we have to take back control of the whole political system before we're ever going to change society, before we're ever going to have safe food. How come it is that energy and transportation are seen as matters of national security and food is not? If they were really worried about food security and terrorism, they're always talking about how they have to protect us from terrorists. Well, the terrorists are right in this country in the form of the people who control all the policy and all the politics. That's all I have to say.
I'd like to read something here that touches on these subsidies, how this came about. This was a speech that Eddie Albert, you know, from, what was the show?
Green Acres,
right? Eddie Albert himself, speaking to the National Farmers Union. And it's something that Willie Nelson posted on commondreams.org. So you can find this just... Google Common Dreams, and then It's About America is the title of this article, not the title of the speech. But Eddie Albert is telling about the Committee for Economic Development just after the war, World War II, that war. And there had been price parity committees, commissions that set price parity for raw materials during the war that kept farmers afloat, kept things fair, farms prospered. After the war, the Committee for Economic Development had this explicit policy, not a conspiracy, this is published, recommended the elimination of one-third of the farm population within 5 years by enforcing low parity pricing. As they stated, the primary benefits of the recommendations would be, one, increased return on corporate investment in agriculture, two, over 2 million farmers and families entering the urban labor pool, which would tend to depress wages, three, lower prices of agricultural products, which would both increase fair trade, increase foreign trade and provide cheaper raw materials for domestic food and fiber processors. Four, invest in projects that break up village life by drawing people to centers of employment away from the village, because village life is a major source of opposition to change. Yeah. They were afraid of the farmers and the labor unions getting together.
Thank you all.